Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the program, we talk about the life and death of Hannah Senish, and she is the woman who is featured in the new documentary, Blessed is the Match. Hannah was born in 1921 and executed in 1944. She was a Palestinian Jew born in Hungary who volunteered to parachute into occupied Hungary for the British Army. She came from an assimilated Hungarian Jewish family, studied at a Protestant school that was open to Catholics, although the Jews paid a lot more money to go to that school. And from there, we'll hear the story of what happened. She is a poet. She was a poet, and her story is captured in a moving fashion by award-winning filmmaker, independent filmmaker Roberta Grossman, who is our guest this hour. Roberta has a passion for history and social justice. She has written and produced more than 40 hours of documentary television, series producer and co-writer of 500 Nations, the 8-hour CBS miniseries on Native Americans. Her feature documentary, Homeland, Four Portraits of Native Action, premiered in February of 2005 and has won many awards all over the world. She's also worked on Footsteps of Jesus, a 4-hour special for the History Channel, and many, many other documentaries. And we're pleased to have Roberta with us this hour to talk about this remarkable woman, Hannah Senish, and an important time in world history. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Roberta, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, great film. Thanks so much for the film. It is really well done. And I just, you know, shame on me. I didn't know very much about her, and I'm so glad that you've brought her story to us because it is one remarkable story. It's amazing what you can do, what one person can do, and at such a young age.
Yeah, I mean, that was the reason, primary reason why I wanted to make the film is that so few people outside of Israel knew about Hannah Senish, and I felt that she was one of the great, you know, certainly great Jewish heroines of the entire Jewish history, and really one of the great heroines of the war, and that her story deserved to be a bit more well-known. So I hope that the film would, you know, help to achieve that in some part.
And why is it that her story was not well-known, whereas Anne Frank's story was very well-known?
You know, I mean, that's very confounding because, not to in any way denigrate Anne Frank. I mean, Anne Frank was a beautiful soul and a beautiful writer and has done so much. Her diary has done so much to keep the story of the Holocaust present. I mean, Anne Frank's diary is the second most published book after the Bible worldwide.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
At least that's what I've heard. And so I wondered, you know, why was Anne Frank so well known? I mean, in essence, Anne Frank was a victim. I mean, she was this young girl who was in hiding and had no chance to do anything, to act in any way. Hannah was a bit older. She had made the decision to emigrate to Palestine right on the eve of the war. And so she was able to do something when the opportunity arose, and she chose to do something. So it seemed to me that Hannah should be at least as well known, or at least known a little bit more than she was.
Right.
I asked one of the scholars in Israel who you know, helped me with the film, you know, the same question you just asked me. Why was Anne Frank so well-known and Hannah so little-known? She said that in our time, that the way to historical knowledge or collective historical knowledge is through the movie theater, and certainly the play and the famous movie went a long way to bringing Anne Frank into the consciousness of the world.
Mm-hmm. And Hannah also left behind exquisite writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she came from a literary family. Her father was a famous playwright in Hungary and Budapest, and columnist, humorous columnist. And so she came from the sort of literary milieu. He died when she was very young, and she started writing poetry when she was in first grade. And she wrote her whole life, both poems and in her diary.
And she lost him at a very young age.
Yeah, he died when she was 6 years old.
Oh, my. That's very, very young, isn't it?
Yes.
They were not, and tell me more about the religious makeup of the family. They weren't necessarily real observant, were they?
Well, you know, there's an element in Budapest of extremely assimilated, Jewish identified, much more what I, you know, kind of think of as, you know, modern contemporary LA and New York.
Right.
Like other places around the country where there are very Jews who are very identified as Jews, but not necessarily religiously observant. And in Budapest at that time, there was a large, you know, community like that. There were also very observant Jews there, but it was a very assimilated a society where there were like 50 or 60% of the doctors, maybe even more, 70% were Jewish writers, industrialists. They were very, very assimilated and very proud of being Hungarian citizens.
Mm-hmm. She, at some point, I think it was one of her early diaries, you talk about her saying that she was born to be a philosopher.
Mm-hmm. Well, she had a very introspective, she was a very brilliant young woman, and she was very soulful. And she it was very introspective. And so she was looking at the world. She was looking at the problems of the world. She was looking at nature. She was looking at her own self, her own soul, and her own personality, and always trying to understand and, you know, had a lot of internal conflict.
Mm-hmm.
She was one of the things, the themes in her diary that runs all the way through it is this boy said he loved me, this boy asked me to marry him, this boy sent me a love letter. And, you know, she sort of just, disdainful of them, of their approaches, and then she thinks, turns it on herself and says, "What's wrong with me? Why don't I respond more favorably to these, you know, these to these compliments?"
Mm-hmm.
So she was kind of had a little bit of an internal tug of war with herself at all times.
And she ended. I think she was asked by one of the prisoners right before she died if she had ever known had a boyfriend or known what it was to be in love, and. One of the survivors who's interviewed said she never knew that.
Yeah, yeah. I think, so obviously what this woman says in the film is that that was a great regret
mm-hmm.
in her life. And, you know, I think that she would have figured out that piece of her life out, you know, had she gotten a little bit older.
You talk about, and I'm wondering if this was anti-Semitism or what the story was, that the school that she went to, this kind of elite Protestant school that was open to Catholics and Jews, but Jews had to pay, what was it, triple the amount
right.
of tuition?
Right.
What was that?
Her mother, well, it was anti-Semitism.
Ah.
Catherine, her mother, who wrote a really amazing memoir of Hannah's childhood, of their life, their family life, and also of their time in prison together. And that memoir forms the narration of the film and is beautifully voiced by Joan Allen in the film. So the film is really told from the point of view of Catherine Senish, Hannah's mother. And the story that I don't believe I told in the film is that she went to complain to the school that it was just outrageous that Hannah, who was their number one student, and indeed she was had to pay triple the tuition, so they reduced it to twice.
Oh, my tuition. Gosh. Oh, thanks a lot. Oh, my. She also was not allowed as a Jew to hold office in the school's literary society.
Yeah, that was really a turning point for Hannah. I mean, up to that time, I think there had been, you know, obviously she ran for the office. She expected to be able to take it, and she won. And after winning the election, she was told she couldn't, that she had to step down and couldn't hold the office. And I think that was really a turning point for her because she realized that anti-Semitism wasn't something that happened to other people. It was something that was happening to her in a very profound way. I mean, the literary society might sound sort of silly, but I mean, she was an aspiring writer. That was her greatest passion. And it was more than that. It was the shock of that because up to that point, she had really seen herself as a Hungarian. And thought that she was accepted as such. Here she came from this, you know, famous family. But no, she was a very hard lesson to learn that she was being seen as other. And that had a profound influence on the development of her idea that the only solution for herself and for the Jewish people of Hungary and for the Jewish people of Europe was to emigrate to Palestine,
mm-hmm.
to build a Jewish state.
In 1938, in Hungary, you document in the documentary that tens of thousands of Jews dismissed from jobs. There was a percentage you could not have so many Jews in so many jobs. Her brother goes to France after he graduates from high school, and she in that year becomes a Zionist to give her life meaning.
Mm-hmm.
She becomes very proud of being Jewish. Tell me about how that developed in her.
Well, I think that as she saw the sort of the noose tightening, I guess there were two choices, at least two obvious choices. One was to fold sold, kind of, as a lot of people,
yes.
you know, quickly converted, changed their names, and I don't judge that. People want to survive. She took a very classic kind of center stance, which is to stand up and you know, sort of was like Jewish power. I mean, it reminds me of the 60s and 70s Black Power, where you know the slogan was Black is beautiful, and Hannah took that stance. You know, she just embraced her Judaism, and she thought the logical conclusion was to become a Zionist and emigrate to Palestine to help build what they hoped would be the Jewish state.
Mm-hmm. And her mother was not entirely, as you can imagine, supportive of her going to Palestine.
Her mother thought it was insane. I think, you know, there were a lot of Zionists in Poland. There were a lot of Zionists in other parts of Europe. And there were Zionists in the provinces of Hungary. But in Budapest, I mean, Hannah was probably one of a handful of Zionists. They were so thoroughly assimilated that it just seemed crazy. I mean, it was like Hannah had, you know, woke up one day and decided that she was going to, you know, live in a tent in the sands of Arabia or something. That, you know, why was this brilliant young woman who had this brilliant future ahead of her going to go live in this godforsaken outpost, which, you know, of course it was.
Right. And not only that, she's applying to go to a girls' agricultural school.
That's part of the whole labor Zionist movement, which was the idea to not only build a state, but to rebuild the Jewish people through labor. And, of course, Jews had been forbidden to own land through much of European history. So there was a feeling that in order for to build the new Jewish nation, the new Jewish person, then the Jews had to sort of dig in the dirt with shovels and with their hands and reconnect to that and become farmers. And that was a way of remaking the Jewish spirit as well as trying to make a nation.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about the story of her brother. Her brother goes to France mm-hmm. when he graduates from high school.
Yes, because he wasn't going to be able to get into university because of the severe quotas that had been imposed. So he went to France. He actually went to study making of textiles in France. And I think he had a really wonderful time in France. I think he liked being away from his mother and his sister. And he also lived, the grandmother lived there. And they were three very serious, somewhat stern women who were, you know, constantly telling him what to do and what not to do. So for him, I think it was a bit of a lark. And there's wonderful pictures of him enjoying
yes.
himself.
He looks like he's having a great time.
Yeah, you know, he's always with a young woman, and he's very handsome, he's very dapper. When Germany invaded France, he escaped over the Pyrenees into Spain by foot and bicycle and was arrested there. And in sort of a silly moment of that kind of crazy, absurd period of time, he was released from prison because the Spanish national ping pong team found out that he was there, and he was a championship ping pong player. So for
no.
a very brief period of time, he played ping pong in Spain. And then this one ship, the Nyasa, left Europe, and it was the one legal ship that went during that whole time period to Palestine, and he was on that. And he arrived in time to spend one day, 24 hours with Hannah before she left on her mission.
Wasn't that something? One day
he
arrived, they could be together the last time they would see each other.
That's right.
Quite remarkable. When she arrives in Palestine, after a little while, she writes to her mother saying that she really does feel as though she's at home.
Mm-hmm. I think that she that's interesting. That's very interesting. She says that, and I think she believed it, but I think it was almost a slogan, because as time goes on, she begins to be more and more agitated and worried and concerned about what's going on in Europe. And so I think it's a stance. I think it's a romantic stance. And in part that it was true, but it wasn't fully true.
Mm-hmm. And how are they getting news, which is horrendous news, about what's going on in Europe?
Well, for a long time they weren't. You know, 39, 40, 41, there wasn't a lot of news. The Nazis were masters of secrecy. If even those who were being deported didn't know where they were going, then certainly all the way in Palestine, there would only be rumor. You know, obviously they knew that there was trouble, that there were pogrom-like incidents going on, but that the systematic genocide of the Jewish people was happening, they didn't know. But then finally, in about 42, I believe, people who had been in Poland in particular, been in the ghettos there and escaped, made their way to Palestine. And that's when the Yishuv, the Jewish community in Palestine, really knew in a concrete way what was going on in Europe. And as Sir Martin Gilbert, historian who's in the film, says, that they, on a certain day, all the newspapers in Palestine, and there were quite a few, were published with black borders around the front page, you know, with headlines that said, stop the massacre, stop the genocide. And there was a day called of, you know, all work was called off, a day of mourning, protest. So they did know, and then the question became, well, what could they do?
Right. She's writing to her mother quite faithfully, but, and this must have been so hard for Catherine, eventually the letters became few and far between, and then they just are very short telegrams sporadically.
Right. Well, I mean, because when England went to war with Germany, they were writing back, and, you know, because England, the British had the mandate in Palestine, then became the, you know, matter of censorship, especially when Germany, the Arrow Cross took over in Hungary, and censorship just became more and more of an issue. But as Catherine says in her memoir, and she says in the film, she was quite satisfied just to get a telegram and to know that Hannah was somewhere far away and safe.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. If you'd like to join this conversation, feel free to do so. Our guest this hour is independent filmmaker Roberta Grossman. Her latest film is Blessed is the Match. She is the director and producer of this film. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about the riveting story, an important story of Hannah Senish. And I'm wondering if many of you were very familiar with her. I'm sure some in our audience are extremely familiar with the life and death of Hannah and would like to comment, or maybe you have questions because you're hearing about her for the first time or don't know very much about her life. We welcome your phone calls. 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Roberta Grossman is our guest, and her documentary just released is Blessed is the Match, The Life and Death of Hannah Senish. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We were talking about the day of mourning, that people not going to jobs, and then this desire on her part and others' part to do something. And by golly, she really does something. She decides to go to British Parachute School. Not many people are earmarked for this, and she is one of only three women to do this, which is extraordinarily remarkable, Roberta.
Yeah, well, what happened is that Hannah had independently, she writes in her diary that she was struck by the idea of going to Hungary to try to rescue her mother and to try to stir up resistance among Jewish youth. And then about 2 weeks later, somebody from the Haganah, the Jewish underground military force in Palestine, approached her to ask her if she was willing to participate in a very similar sort of mission. So it was another one of the really sort of interesting coincidences in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And the mission was organized under the auspices of the British. They became the Jewish parachutists became members of the British Air Force. But there was two missions, and one mission was the British mission, which, although it was under the Air Force, was a special operations or intelligence, essentially, operation. They were charged with trying to rescue downed British pilots through underground channels in Europe, and also to try to make, you know, stronger connections between the British and undergrounds operating, anti-Nazi resistance operating in Europe. So mm-hmm. theirs was really a spy mission, an intelligence gathering mission. And then the part of the Yishuv, the Jewish community of Palestine, the mission was to try very different, which was to try to bring information to the Jewish communities in Europe that were still standing, not many were, about what was really happening, and to try to stir up resistance to the Nazis.
Mm-hmm. So she had to be, she was trained in codes and signaling and operating radios, et cetera. You not only had to be really smart, I mean, it's interesting that she had the kind of brain that could do all of this kind of technical work, and also she's a poet, and also you had to be enormously strong physically, I would think,
radio was
to do this.
Heavy.
Yeah, and parachuting and walking and all of that.
Well, remember, she was a kibbutznik, so and most of them were, so they were, you know, they were healthy young people who had been working as farmers.
And how was she chosen for this? Do you know what the process was?
Well, she was chosen as the others were chosen because of their, she was a recent immigrant, so it means that she knew the conditions in her country of origin, where she would be going. She knew the language, she knew the land. And she was chosen because she was a member of a kibbutz and part of this sort of socialist Zionist, you know, group in Palestine that was very, had a very sort of independent spirit. And I suppose she was chosen for her intelligence and her youth.
Mm-hmm. And also, she writes, I think, at this time, I don't know if it's in a poem or a letter, that she has two great loves in her life, and she acts on her loves, if anybody does, her nation, her people, and her mother.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that, I mean, what happened is that, you know, we were talking a little bit before about how Catherine felt during the war years in terms of their separation, and I think that she, although she obviously, you know, missed Hannah very much, was very happy that she was safe as things got worse and worse and worse in Hungary for the Jewish people. But for Hannah, it was, as for so many young people in Palestine, it was torture, not knowing what was happening to her family.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, she just had this idea, part of her hubris, she had this idea that she could just go to Budapest and pluck her mother out. And she tried to do it.
And discuss a little bit more what was going on in Hungary. Things were horrible, but they weren't as bad, if you can even say that, as the worst atrocities came to Hungary last. Is that fair to say?
That is fair to say. The ruler of the country, Horthy, was asked several times by Hitler personally to allow the deportation of the Hungarian Jews, and he said no. Ultimately, It's unclear to me what actually happened, but the Germans, what they said was that Horthy was going to make a separate peace with the Allies. I mean, he was an ally of Germany, but when Horthy tried to leave the country or tried to make the separate peace with the Allies, the Germans used this as an excuse, whether it was true or not, it's a little bit debatable, to invade Hungary, and that was in 1944. And the SS came on the heels of the army, and in 8 weeks, by this time they had a very, very efficient operation, and they had the support of the local Hungarian Nazis. There was an Aerocross takeover in Hungary. Aerocross were the Hungarian Nazis. And within 8 weeks, they had deported over 400,000 Hungarian Jews from the provinces of Hungary. And the Jews of Budapest were the last really large Jewish community standing in Europe.
Within 8 weeks, they accomplished that.
Yeah, it was really a model of efficiency.
Oof. And what about her mother during the early war years? What was she doing? What was Catherine doing?
I think she was just living her life as she had led it. Seeing her family, taking care of her mother. Her mother died before the war. Seeing her family, seeing her sisters, corresponding with her children, making sure that, you know, taking care of them as best she could from afar.
Mm-hmm.
She managed the literary affairs of her dead husband.
So let's go back to Hannah deciding she is going to be a parachuter. The film dramatically has her reenacting, has her landing, and she gets captured pretty quickly, pretty soon thereafter.
Well, when Hannah's group landed, all the parachutists landed in Yugoslavia to hook up with the Yugoslavian partisans. And part of the idea was that they would try to help rescue down pilots in sort of an underground railroad that would go through the partisan territory in Yugoslavia, and then get those pilots back into the war. And for the Jews and the Jewish parachuters, they'd hoped to rescue whomever they could the same route. But when they arrived in Yugoslavia, they marched. They spent several weeks marching, and they finally arrived at the headquarters, the partisan headquarters. And when they arrived there, they found out that only 5 days earlier that this invasion of Hungary by Germany had taken place.
Yes.
So it changed the whole equation. As Sir Martin Gilbert says in the film, that now a Jewish person who just a week ago, 5 days ago, could have taken a train, gotten to Budapest with normal papers, and now as a Jew, couldn't go. So then the decision came whether to call off the mission, and it was the general consensus that the mission should be called off, but Hanna disagreed, and she decided to cross the border into Hungary.
Mm-hmm. And there is a gentleman, he subsequently died, but there is a gentleman who was on the mission with her who said that he admired her so greatly, but he didn't like her. Part of the reason was because perhaps he didn't want to go ahead with the mission and she did?
I think that that's part of it. I think that many people who knew Hanna, just found her to be insufferably self-confident.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in this case, he considered himself the leader of their group. He had made the decision that they shouldn't cross, and she was defying him. He also felt that she may be putting the rest of them in danger, and the partisans that they were with in danger by crossing as she did. So he thought she was, if not officially so, then just and generally insubordinate. And also, I don't know that Hanna, some people she rubbed the wrong way. And maybe some young men she rubbed the wrong way because she wasn't a normal girl.
No, she wasn't. And the self-confidence then was that was a long time ago, so it was probably even more unusual to have that kind of self-confidence. What do you think? Did she put their lives in danger?
I don't think so, because when she was captured and she was tortured for the radio code, which could have put a lot of people in danger, she didn't divulge the code. So that's the critical piece, is that she did not betray her comrades.
And she, as she was carrying forward, she left behind a piece of paper. Tell us that story.
Well, Hanna was always writing and always writing poems. And Reuven Daphne, the man we were just talking about, went on and had a long and distinguished career at Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum in Israel. He said that just as she was crossing the border, that she handed him a piece of paper, and he was really aggravated with her because, at this really critical and dangerous moment, she was writing poetry and giving it to him. And she said, if I don't return, give this to my, friends at the kibbutz. And he was so mad that he threw it down on the ground after they parted ways. And then about an hour later, he realized, it's just his conscience got the better of him.
Right.
He went back, and he said it took him over an hour to find it, and he found a little piece of paper, stuck to a bush or something, and he kept it. And that was Blessed is the Match, which is her most famous poem.
Mm. Do you have that in front of you?
I do not.
You don't, but it's close to you?
I can look for it.
Well, we'll take a pause in a moment if you can find it in 20
seconds. Yeah, I have to grab her diary.
Okay, yeah, I would like to have you read it for us rather than have me read it. Meanwhile, all right, so she's in prison. Meanwhile, her mother, talk about the story of how her mother finds out where she is and her attempts to get her out.
Well, when Hanna was captured, she was brought to Budapest, and there she was heavily interrogated. And they discovered that she wasn't, this girl from Palestine. She was actually Aniko Senesh, a girl who grew up in Budapest, and that her mother was still living there. So in a further effort to try to extract the radio code from her, they arrested her mother. And the two of them were brought together in an interrogator's office. They hadn't seen each other in over 5 years.
Mm.
So it was, Hanna was very beaten up and had been tortured, and it was a pretty dramatic reunion, and really heartbreaking. But what's remarkable about it is that although they were given no time to talk to each other, that they were able to stand together. And Catherine says in her memoir that if Hannah didn't want to talk, she had good reason not to, and she would in no way try to influence her otherwise. But basically what they were being told, Hannah was being told, you know, tell us your radio code and whatever else you know, or you will kill your mother. And they were telling Catherine, convince her to talk to us, or you'll never see your daughter again. So they were under the most enormous pressure.
Mm-hmm. And what was the radio code? What was
she? It was the British. It was her way. She was caught with a British radio. The radio code was her way of announcing herself, so that the information that followed would be seen as legitimate.
I see. And you think for a while in your documentary that she's going to be okay. The war seems to be coming to an end. She's taken walks in the courtyard at the prison. You are hopeful, and so much is a matter of this timing on this, that things are going to be okay. It's fairly dramatic timing when she's executed, isn't it? Her mother's in the prison.
Yeah, I mean, her mother had been, they were in prison together for 3 months, sometimes able to see each other, and then she was released. It was really a lot of chaos in Hungary at that time. And what was happening, the prison, they were in prison, they weren't in a camp. They were being held basically for crimes against Hungary. There were a lot of high-born women in that prison being held sort of as hostages. And as the war progressed, there was a tremendous amount of chaos. The control was sort of going back and forth in terms of Hannah and her mother, was going back and forth between the Gestapo and the Arrow Cross and the Hungarian military. And they weren't necessarily all working in concert. So it was a lot of chaos. And Catherine, in the midst of this, was released, and she then was able to hire a lawyer to represent Hannah because she was tried by the Hungarian military for treason against Hungary. But ultimately, in the very last days of the war, as they could hear the Russians on the outside of Budapest, the Nazis and the Hungarians who had collaborated with them and the Hungarian fascists, they were fleeing, and one Hungarian Nazi, his name was Captain Simon, who had been in charge of her case, as he was heading out of town, he decided to sort of clean up behind him and executed Hannah. Mm. And Catherine was sitting in Simon's office waiting for a permit to see Hannah at that moment. So when Simon came to his office, and he was leaving Budapest that moment, Catherine was there waiting for him, and he was the one who told her what had just happened to her daughter.
Oh, my. We welcome phone calls. If you'd like to join our conversation, if not, you're probably just interested in the story, but I'm sure some of you have family memories of events in Europe during this horrendous time, or you know the story of Hannah, or you'd like to ask more questions about her story. Roberta Grossman is our guest, director and producer of Blessed is the Match, The Life and Death of Hannah Senish. We asked her about the poem that the documentary receives its title as a result of the poem, and the story of how the poem came to be and was rescued. So we're going to have her read that to us in a moment. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. In 1944, at the age of 22, she parachuted Hannah Senish into Nazi-occupied Europe in an effort to save her mother and Jews of Hungary and elsewhere. She was captured, tortured, killed by the Nazis, and we're talking about her life and Jewish resistance. She was a parachutist, and her story is absolutely remarkable, and it is the subject of Roberta's documentary. We'll also give you information about how you can see this documentary, which is well worth your eyes and ears. Phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Roberta Grossman is our guest. Her film, her documentary is Blessed is the Match, The Life and Death of Hannah Senish. Our phone number, again, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. As the phone calls are coming in, did you find the poem?
I did.
Thank you. Will you read it?
Sure.
Okay.
It's the poem is called Blessed is the Match. Blessed is the match consumed in kindling flame. Blessed is the flame that burns in the secret fastness of the heart. Blessed is the heart with strength to stop its beating for honor's sake. Blessed is the match consumed in kindling flame. So I see this as Hannah's explanation of why she crossed the border, that she understands that the chances of survival are very, very slim, but that she hopes that that idea of that one match or one candle can light the darkness is true. So I see it as an explanation, as a suicide note, and I think it's a I thought it was a fit title for the film.
She is portrayed in your documentary as being quite fearless. Do you think that she ever? I know she asks herself at one point in her diary or in a poem whether or not this may be a selfish act for her. But it would strike me as being quite the opposite. I'm wondering if she ever had fears about anything, Roberta?
I think she probably did have fears. I think when she was captured, she was probably terrified. I think when she was confronted with her mother in that horrible way, I think she was terrified. I think that she very much didn't want to die. But I think she had sort of a cloak over her, a cloak of youth, and I think sometimes that young people really don't, or perhaps all of us, don't believe we're really going to die.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it, what you document here must stay with you all of your days, isn't it incredible what people went through or weren't able to survive?
Yeah.
What a time it was.
Yeah, really a horrible time.
Absolutely.
I think about it constantly, and I have whole life. Yeah.
For your whole life?
Yeah.
Oh.
I started reading about the Holocaust when I was, just in elementary school. And actually, I read Hannah Senish's diary when I was in junior high. And, fell in love with her in that time. You know, one sort of idealistic young person reading another young idealistic person's diary. And I became a filmmaker right out of college, and I wanted to make a film about Hannah Senish right from the beginning. And tried at different times, but wasn't able to do so. Different sets of circumstances. Wasn't able to launch the project, wasn't able to raise the money. The way we made it was quite ambitious. So when things finally came together about 5 years ago, I was very glad about the timing and that it had taken the decades because I had amassed some experience as a documentary filmmaker.
Yes.
Made a lot of films. So I felt like I had both the confidence to take on the sort of iconic subject and also to convey to other people that they could trust me, that I could do a good job.
Right.
And more importantly, I think, was that by that time I was a mother and I was closer in age to Catherine Senish than to Hannah. And working with the film's writer, Sophie Sartain, I realized that the way to tell the story was as a mother-daughter love story.
Mm-hmm.
And to tell the film from Catherine's point of view. And I think that that made a very big difference in raising the money for the film and for the way that audiences respond to the film. Because heroes are really kind of hard to understand. We can't really relate to them. Most of us would not do these kinds of things. So that can become kind of boring. But the story of a mother watching her really brilliant child, take actions which would ultimately cost her her life, that's a pretty gripping story.
It sure is.
Many people can relate to.
Yeah, it's just the word I was going to use. It is an incredibly gripping story. Let's take a call from Marty from Green Bay. Hi, Marty. Hello? Well, maybe it's not Marty. Hello?
Hello, sorry.
Oh, it's okay. Is this Marty?
Yeah.
Hey, Marty, go ahead.
I just have a question about where the film's going to be seen, and is there a chance for a DVD?
Yeah, well, thanks. The film was shown, I believe, last week on Independent Lens, on PBS on Independent Lens. It was broadcast nationally. I'm not sure when the broadcast was or if it has happened yet in your area. You could check PBS listings. The DVD for the is now available pretty much everywhere. Amazon, Netflix, all the usual places. You can also get it at the website of the film, which is www.blessedisthematch.com.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks
Bye-bye.
Very much for the call. Is it going to be distributed? You talk about as a young girl, you were riveted by this story, and and by this whole era. Will this be distributed in schools around the country, Roberta?
Yeah, we had the good fortune of working, as we were making the film, we were working at the same time with a wonderful organization called Facing History and Ourselves, which is a leader, that organization is a leader in teaching the Holocaust and genocide in general, and tolerance to junior high and high school students. And we created a 45-minute version of the film working with Facing History so that it was accessible to teachers and to their classrooms. And Facing History also created a really wonderful study guide to go along with that 45-minute version of the film. So that's available through Facing History.
Hmm. Barb is next. Hi, Barb.
Hi. This is a really great topic, and I'm in a car, so I pulled over, and I'll hang up for my answer.
Okay.
Be hungry. The neo-fascist party made quite a got quite a percentage of seats, and I was wondering if Roberta Grossman how felt about that, if that's kind of beginning to go back and mirror what was happening back when the subject of her film was a lot. You think of that election, and I'll hang up.
Okay, Barb, thank you.
I think two things. First of all, thanks for your question. I think two things. That one, that we have to be ever vigilant about fascist and neo-fascist movements anywhere in the world. But I perhaps would like to believe that we are not soon going to return to a time and to a series of events like we had in Europe during World War II. Which is not to say, of course, that genocides aren't occurring in the world in other places, and they remain as confounding and difficult to stop. But I think the kind of systematic, Europe-wide, continent-wide genocide that we saw is unlikely to happen again in our lifetimes, or at least I'd like to believe so.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about her nephews? I was pleased to see them interviewed. They just seem like such thoughtful and intelligent young men now. And it was good to know that the family line had continued.
Well, I guess in a way, Hannah Senesch did rescue her mother, because while Catherine was in prison with Hannah, there were these deportations and random killings going on in Budapest. Lots and lots of Jewish people were deported or killed. And although Catherine was caught up in a sort of a final death march at the end of the war, she was able to escape and survive. She went to Palestine, where she was reunited with her son, Giora. And Giora had two sons, and during Giora's lifetime, it was his job to not only take care of his mother, but to take care of the legacy with his mother, Hannah's legacy. And when they both passed, that sort of honor and burden passed to Giora's sons, who had never met Hannah, but they certainly knew all about her. Catherine lived into her 90s, and they were very close to their grandmother, and they went to her house every Friday night. They heard the stories over and over and over again. So they, and of course their father, talked about his sister. So they, David and Eitan Senesch, they are now the bearers of the legacy in Israel, and they were really quite wonderful and remarkable in the making of the film. Eitan Senesch basically worked with me, probably occupied most of his time for the better part of about 3 years.
Oh, my.
They made accessible to me an amazing archive that of photographs, over 1,300 photographs, most of which had never been seen before.
Mm.
We were able to do high-resolution scans and work with a scholar to identify who's in the pictures, what's the year, what's happening, how it relates to the diary. So the archive is in much better shape now than it was before the film was made. I feel really good about that. And they also made accessible to the film unpublished letters between the family members, unpublished portions of Hannah's diary. So they were really great in terms of enriching the film. And Eitan came on every shoot in Hungary, in Israel. He came to Los Angeles when I was editing.
Oh, my.
Yeah, so they were very, very, it was very hard for them to trust somebody to tell Hannah's story. And they wanted to do everything they could to have the story told in the way that they thought was the right way. I mean, they didn't have, in the parlance of filmmaking, they didn't have final cut. They couldn't say, no, you can't say that, or no, you can't say it that way. But I would not have been happy if they hadn't been happy with the film. So we did a lot of arm wrestling. And I think it made for a better film. And in the end, I'm happy to say they were very happy with the film.
And how did you get their trust?
Trust is a mysterious thing. You know, I went to Israel after a year of talking on the phone that kind of went nowhere. I went to Israel and we sat down together. And I think that just instinctually we both felt that we could trust each other.
Yes. And what about her legacy in Israel? Tell me, do people visit her gravesite, or are people very, very aware of her?
People are very aware of Hannah Senesh in Israel. I mean, she is a national heroine. But in probably in a similar way, of course, it's not as long of a history, but probably in a similar way, you know, you and I know about Abraham Lincoln, and we know something about him, but we don't know in great detail. In Israel, every Israeli school child can recite at least one or two of her poems. One of her poems, Eli, Eli, was set to music in the 50s. That's played on Holocaust Remembrance Day, Holocaust Remembrance occasions in Israel. And young parachutists, you know, they learn about Hannah Senesh today, continue to take inspiration from her. But she has become a bit of a statue there. And the fullness of her story is not known there. So I've had a lot of Israelis tell me when they've seen the film that they knew something of her story, but they didn't know about her meeting with her mother in Budapest, you know, the imprisonment together. They didn't know a lot of things.
Right, and they probably didn't know a lot of the writings because you uncovered those. You look at, there's no doubt when you see the documentary that a whole lot went into it. Little did I know how much did go into it, that this was a really lengthy process for you to read all of the documents, to do all of the interviews, to do the recreation, which is beautifully done, I might add. It's just not in your way at all. It's just part of the documentary which flows. But there was a lot of work involved in this, Roberta.
Yeah, it was a pretty big rock to push uphill.
Right. And it's a hard time for independent filmmakers, you say in some interview I read with you, too. It's not easy to do a film like this and to get support to do a film like this.
Well, it's always been hard to raise money for documentary films, but it's especially hard now because with the downturn in the economy and so many philanthropic foundations having lost a great deal of money in the stock market, it's probably hard for funders to rationalize giving money to a film rather than to a medical clinic for poor children or something, more direct services. So it's just the difficulty has increased. But when one has a film that one feels he or she has to make, you find a way.
Mm-hmm. What other films have you felt you had to make?
Which other ones besides this one?
Yes.
I don't know that I've ever felt about another film the way I feel about this one. I mean, this felt like the most important thing I can do in my life. And so I'm very, very gratified to have been able to do it. I'm working right now on a new project. Did a pilot for a potential PBS documentary on the history of contemporary Native American history.
Hmm.
I feel pretty charged about that because that story, the story from the turn of the century to the present day, has never been told in a comprehensive way. And so I think that that's one of these untold stories that I get pretty fired up about, and so I'm excited to work on that.
Isn't that something, what you said, well, all of what you've said, but the film that you just made is the most important film that you will make in your lifetime?
Well, I think so, at least to me.
Right, right. Well, I'm glad you made it. Once again, how do people get a copy of this? Because we would like to let people know
Sure.
that it's available. Blessed is the Match. The Life and Death of Hannah Senesh. How do you get it?
You get it in all the places where you get any DVD.
Okay.
It's been widely released from a company called Docurama in New York, so it should be available to you on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, Netflix. You can also get the film and learn more about the film, more about Hannah Senesh at the film's website, which is www.blessedisthematch.com.
Okay.
And can also purchase the film there. And educational institutions, schools, libraries need to go to the website and not buy it at the consumer home video. That's a little plug for protecting the copyright of films.
Yes. Well, Roberta, thank you so much. Thanks for doing this film and for being on the air talking with us about it.
I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
Mm-hmm. A great pleasure. The film, it's a documentary, Blessed is the Match, The Life and Death of Hannah Senish. And she told you how you can get a copy of this. It is one gripping story. There's no doubt about that, and done quite beautifully by our guest, Roberta Grossman, director and producer of Blessed is the Match, The Life and Death of Hannah Senish. Roberta is an independent filmmaker. She has done many, many hours of documentaries, including Homeland, Four Portraits of Native Action, 500 Nations, 8-hour CBS miniseries on Native Americans. She's done that and Homeland and quite a few other documentaries as well for U.S. News and World Report, produced this Heroines of the Hebrew Bible and Judas for the A&E series Mysteries of the Bible. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Tomorrow at 9 o'clock, it's Bill Nye, the Science Guy, and we'll talk about the brain at 10. So stay with us this week and stay with the station for great conversations ahead.